Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to our podcast,
Life After the Letters. I'm Amelie.
And I'm Suba.
We're friends that met whilst working our first shifts as junior doctors.
And we're here to talk about the stories and challenges that we face every day.
Today I have the pleasure of introducing Dr. Robin Fawcett. She's a GP, a bibliophile, a mother of two adorable boys, an American who skipped across the pond, lover of nature, and a breast cancer survivor. She has an inspiring Instagram account where she shares her life, gems of wisdom on peaceful living, raising children, and life after cancer. I first saw Robin's TED talk on the importance of preventative medicine and on the real pressures on the NHS. It's not always about doctors absconding to Australia or New Zealand. So Robin is here with us today to talk about her journey through medicine and her experience of healthcare and illness, both as a doctor and as a patient. Hi, Robin.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for coming on today. We've all been like chatting away for the last 10, 15 minutes and having a blast. So it's good to finally get on the air and record the gems.
Absolutely. We almost could have recorded an episode before we even sat down here. And Robin, Robin's been here for about over an hour already.
I know.
So thank you so much for being so kind. When I first came into the wing this morning, I was like, hi, Robin, sorry for making you wait. She said, oh, I haven't been waiting very long at all, but I could see you when you signed in. And it was literally about 25 minutes prior. And I was like, oh my gosh, we are terrible. She's going to hate us. And I was out of breath as well. So thank you so much.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I'm always happy to have an opportunity to sit with a cup of tea and my book.
So what are you reading at the moment? It looks really interesting.
So I'm reading a book called A General Theory of Love.
Mm-hmm. And dum, dum, dum.
I know, and it sounds really fluffy. And it was a gift from a friend years ago. Mm. And I have to confess, I hadn't read it until now because I thought it was super fluffy. And then something made me pull it out, and it's written by three psychiatrists. So Dr. Lewis, Dr. Amini, and Dr. Lannan in San Francisco. Mm. And it's really an analysis of what science can tell us and can't tell us about our emotions the heart. Mm-hmm. So they talk about love, but it's really about our emotional selves. Mm. And again, that kind of division between science and our heart and our emotional selves. And it's just beautifully written.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I'm loving it.
I honestly think like psychiatrists have some of the best grips on that side of human nature, because it's something they see in their practice. I think something that's drawn them into that in the first place. And I feel like all my experiences of incredible psychiatrists have been like, you guys have like another window into the human experience, and I want to look through that window too. Yes. Like, I almost ended up doing psychiatry. It was one of my initial like specialties that I had.
And Suba's had so many initial specialties.
Everything. But genuinely psychiatry, and I did a psychology BSc, and it was always something that I've loved and found so interesting. Because really, and it sounds, I think the core of it is actually a bit egotistical. You really want to know yourself. You want to understand yourself. Mm. But you can't really do that because it's so hard to look at yourself in a very real way.
Yes.
So you want to kind of look at other people in this almost, well, it's not really voyeuristic, but it's like, maybe if I understand you and your emotions and your thoughts, then maybe I can understand myself.
Yeah.
So that's kind of what we're all trying to do.
Yes.
Psychiatrists are dope, basically. That's what I'm trying to get at. They're really cool.
How did you find yourself going into GP or family medicine? Mm. Or what was even your journey in the first place?
Yeah, let's move on. How did you end up here? And what took you into medicine? and your specialty?
Well, first, I was nodding the whole time you said that you've had all these different ideas about what specialty. I think that's how I ended up in general practice as a family doctor, is I couldn't actually make a decision. And so this was the best specialty that allowed me to still see everything. And it's actually funny you introduced me as a bibliophile. I think my main reason for becoming a doctor in the first place was really literature. Yeah. I don't have any medics in my family. I'm the black sheep for sure. And
but a successful black sheep.
Yeah. The kind of black sheep that your family is very proud to welcome to the fold.
And yet confused by. Yeah. And I think my the sort of influences for me were doctors that I read about in books and a lot of old literature. And so I think, again, that family doctor model of the kind of the village doctor who knows everybody in the village and knows their story, knows the whole family dynamic. And
the gossip of the village.
Exactly. Yeah, there was the Agatha Christie. Definitely some Agatha Christie in there as well. Not highbrow literature necessarily. But I always say, you know, Dr. Beverly Crusher from Star Trek: The Next Generation played a role for sure. TV
that's
doctors,
good, that's good.
But I think it was this idea of being a little bit of a detective.
Absolutely.
And to your point about sort of, I think it's really a fascination with the human experience and wanting to bear witness to that and play a role in, and being a presence for people as they're walking through a path of illness and healing.
Yeah, and then you were telling us, so you're obviously American, as I keep mentioning.
I am.
And I've said it so many times, I'm like obsessed by everything American. Can you talk to us about your journey from, well, literally across the world, and how you came to be settled over here?
So this time around, it's been almost 9 years of living in the UK, but I lived here as a child, so we were an expat American family in sort of the home counties just outside London in South Buckinghamshire. My father's job transferred us over here in 1985. And it was supposed to be for 1 year, which became two. And because the school systems are quite different. Especially for my older brother, who was 11 at the time. My parents chose an American school for us because, again, we thought it was temporary and that we'd need to transition back. And then as the years went on, it became harder and harder to make that shift. And so we just stayed in the U.S. system. And then at 18, moved back to the U.S. for university. So, and in the States, medical training is quite different. So I did...
So you applied for... So let's slow down a little bit. So you applied... Did you have majors and minors that you were choosing at the time? Or were you like always, oh, I'm going to be pre-med... go into medicine, or how did it work?
I thought I would be pre-med. I knew that I would study something science-y. I actually also, this is less known and a little embarrassing perhaps, but I really wanted to be an astronaut.
Oh, did you? That's so not embarrassing.
That's so cool.
No, but like for real wanted to be an astronaut. Not when I was 9, but when I was, you know, 17.
Like an adult.
So that is a little embarrassing. You don't find many 17-year-olds who are quite serious about wanting to be an astronaut.
No, you don't. That's cool, though.
But there's always physicians in space.
Yes.
So that's also something that's not well known, but there's, especially now, they're not fighter pilots anymore, generally. They're scientists and researchers.
Absolutely.
And so I, so in the US you apply not for a major, you just apply to university. And so I decided, I was pretty sure I wanted to study biology. And then it's usually in your second year that you have to declare a major. And so you select the courses that are going to allow you to fulfill the requirements for that degree. But there's always a lot of other stuff.
Absolutely. Was there anything surprising that you picked up during the time when you were at university that has really informed how you think now?
I did a Religions of Asia course, and I think that first opened my eyes to a very different way of looking at, I guess, the human experience and what life is all about, and a search for meaning that was so unfamiliar to, you know, someone who is of Scottish and German ancestry, of Protestants, you know, so it was really outside of our family experience, but really profound, and... You know, it was an introductory course, so it was nothing at a particularly deep level, but it was enough to get me thinking. And I think to get me asking questions about the things that I took for granted in my everyday life and frankly, a lot of the dominant culture in the United States. And so I thought I would do medicine. And part of my journey really involves my father, who was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer just before I graduated from school.
Mm-hmm.
So throughout my first year at university, he was being treated at the hospital attached to my university. And
wow.
So my parents had moved from the UK back to the US to be close to my brother and me.
Mm-hmm. And were you living in the same state at the time? In the same area at the time?
Yes, my parents were about half an hour from the university.
Okay.
And
they had done that specifically to be
exactly.
Near
you. I was in my first year and my brother was in his final year at the same university.
Mm-hmm. Me and my brother also went to the same university.
Which is funny because I don't know about you and your brother, but mine, we are so different. I mean, we are chalk and cheese. And my brother is a computer scientist and a real introvert.
Yeah,
other than the fact that we both love books and history,
that
is pretty much so we hardly ever crossed paths, and it was a pretty big university. But it was amazing to have the whole family together through what was, you know, a pretty awful year.
Yeah, absolutely.
But what a gift that I could, in between classes,
mm-hmm.
I could pop in if my dad was getting a treatment
yeah.
and see my parents, and they could come around, and I could go home for weekends and do laundry and all of that kind of thing. So I did all my pre-med courses, because of course, so we do, as undergrads, some of the things you do in your first couple of years of med school here. So all of the chemistry and the biology and the physics and all of that, I was working through as an undergrad.
Yeah.
And then when it came to actually apply, I had second thoughts.
Okay.
And I thought, am I actually on some weird mission to heal my father who had died at the end of my first year?
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, hang on, am I going into this for all the wrong reasons?
Mm-hmm.
And I had done some shadowing of junior doctors locally and at my university. And most of them, frankly, turned to me and said, don't do it.
Interesting.
Which is such a phenomenon. It's such a phenomenon now.
Yes,
like,
I'm sure it's true here too.
So
they're all
insane.
Like, go do something else. And this was 1999, 2000.
Okay,
and so, you know, the economy was booming. This is before the dot-com bubble burst.
Yeah.
And, you know,
all
everyone
was growth in other aspects.
And everyone
of the
I knew had, you know, 9 job offers coming out of university for like fabulous salaries and amazing companies doing exciting things. And so the junior doctors were all sort of looking at each other and being like, what are we doing?
Yeah.
We
you know?
Made the wrong choice.
Yeah. And so the message I got was, don't do it, don't do it. And I thought, hang on, am I actually sure about why I want to do this?
Yeah.
And so I put all of my medical stuff on a shelf and went to work for a software company.
Oh, did you?
No, you
did. I did. I did marketing for a software company for a year.
Wow.
And hated it.
Okay.
Which
is
what I thought. I always knew that I didn't want to work in an office.
Yeah.
And there I was working in an office. And it was amazing in a lot of ways. And I learned a ton. I met some amazing people.
Mm.
Austin, Texas is just the coolest city in the world.
Yeah.
It was a great place to be.
Yeah.
But I realized pretty quickly that this was not going to be
not for you.
Yeah.
And that dichotomy of like software, marketing, and medicine, what did it make you think about, okay, this is why I choose medicine now?
I think it was a concept of service. I think I didn't feel like I was doing anything to make the world a better place, which sounds awful, and I'm not trying to diss people brother who work in software.
Yeah.
But it just, for me, it didn't light me up. And again, having to come in and sit at a desk in an office environment and, you know, write press releases. I mean, it was just awful.
Yeah.
For me.
Yeah.
It just
and
wasn't
my
thing.
Like you say, you know, even when it comes to service, there's different levels of what it means to to do something
service.
In service. Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, it, obviously you wanted to be more frontline service. No,
yes.
Like that's the kind of vibe I was getting.
It wasn't like the juicy good stuff that, you know, kind of fired me up inside.
Yeah.
And I think also it's that, you know, it was a job that paid really well, especially at the time.
Yeah.
And you think, oh gosh, you know, you've got to find these things out. Am I a lifestyle person who wants like a fancy car and a really good salary and punch the clock at work so that I can go travel and do whatever?
Yeah.
And that is the right thing. Or be of service in other ways outside of my job.
Absolutely.
There's many ways of doing this. But for me, I realized actually that wasn't the path.
Mm-hmm.
But it was something I needed to tick. And I think I saw that. So to fast forward, I then did a year of genetic research, thinking, well, maybe research is the way forward.
Yeah.
I would love to see your CV. This I'm literally laughing.
What hasn't she done?
Yeah.
And that was just incredibly dull for me. Again, it was, you know, the office was in a basement. It didn't have windows. And anyone who's done medical research knows that
like,
you're constantly fighting for grant money.
Yeah.
And that research is, I mean, it's so important, but it is such a slog. And you
have to
keep at it, and you just, you know, and I was enrolling families in a genetic research study, again, interesting in hindsight, and it was interviewing families and getting, you know, painting the family tree out, and painstaking detail.
Yes.
So important.
Yes.
And
and it's not just not,
but
for
not
me.
For, not for everyone. not for everyone.
Absolutely.
And so then I traveled in Southeast Asia for a while. I did a year of the kind of backpacker in Southeast Asia while I was figuring out what was coming next.
Yeah.
And it was actually on the back of a moped in Phnom Penh
that I'm literally sort of seeing this in such a visual way. Like, you go from the basement, now you're on a scooter and, like, you know, it's just amazing.
And Phnom Penh is this amazing city, which obviously has, you know, a horrific history of the Khmer Rouge. And it's so, you know, the people who had survived it are still very much alive. And so it's the first time I was exposed to sort of horrors of history that are so fresh and so recent.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
So still alive in the everyday experience of the people who live in that city. And exposed to some of the NGOs who were there. And I thought, well, this is much more my kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then it was on the back of that moped that I was like, maybe I should just go to medical school. Back to square one.
Yeah, exactly.
But by the time I did go to medical school, I realized I had sort of had all those wobbles and worked out of that. And so I was sure that this was what I wanted to do. And I saw my classmates, as I'm sure you have, go through that existential, hang on a second, is this for me? And I felt so lucky that I'd gone through that before I was doing the crazy hours and being shouted at by senior doctors and going through all of that stuff that you go through.
Yeah.
I at least underneath it all knew I was in the right place.
Absolutely. And when you said that, I was thinking, even though we're joking, you said that you've gone back to square one, actually you're coming from a different perspective. And it's almost like when you see the mature medics in the hospital compared to us, like...
The 18-year-olds.
Yeah, people who started at 18 and have finished at, like, what, 23, 24?
Yeah.
It's just a completely different life experience that they've been exposed to.
Yeah.
And I think that's also when you start reading a little bit more, your mind starts getting opened up. You start thinking about the ways that you want to approach medicine and why you want to come into it.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was really cool to think about more, how can I be a clinician? How do I sharpen this space?
And I think that's one difference I've seen, you know, having grown up in the NHS really as a child.
Yeah.
And so I'm very familiar with the UK system and then now being back in it as a doctor. You know, I'm constantly asked about differences between the US and the UK. And I think that's one of the good things and the bad things is that you're in school for a lot longer in the US, but by the time you're actually practicing, by the time you've got the title of doctor, you're older, and you have just a little bit more life experience under your belt, and I think that's an asset, both
just
in terms
by virtue of time.
Just by virtue of time. And I think that provides a little bit more kind of emotional maturity and resilience.
Yeah.
But I think it also means you bring something a bit richer to your patients.
Can I ask you a question? And it's not directly on the differences between America and the UK, but more so, in your TED talk, you talk about, like, the narratives that we find in the UK media about the NHS, the shortage of doctors, when it really should be the increasing, like, ageing population and the sicker patients. What's the narrative like in the US, would you be?
About healthcare in
healthcare?
General?
Yeah. Is that a big question?
Yes, and I think it's interesting because it is a very different narrative. I think the narrative in the US tends to be one that's very focused on what is the ideal medical model. I think the US is still tied up in knots over should we have single payer system, which is the big political hot potato at the moment. But also, you know, Medicare and Medicaid and how much should nurses be doing, how much should advanced practice nurses be doing, physician assistants, the doctors. In the US there's also lots of people call themselves doctors, so that's a difference. That chiropractors are referred to as doctors, and even now, sometimes physios are often PhDs now. And so there's this whole, I think it's more of an identity crisis that you see. But also, it's the spiraling cost of healthcare in the US, which, you know, they pay, the amount spent on healthcare per person is more than twice in the US than what it is here.
Yeah.
And there's this sense that it's spiraling out of control. But what could be done about it?
Yeah, absolutely. And it almost seems so segmented that it's difficult to get a complete hold of it.
Yes.
So I would even be interested. I feel like the UK, in the UK, people have such a difficult understanding of what the NHS and what healthcare really means. So I wonder, in the US, when you've got such a fragmented system, how do you even think about what healthcare can mean for you? Because you've never had, like, a taxpayer system.
Right.
So does that even feel real to people?
No, and that's one of the challenges, is that it's divided up into people who have health insurance and people who don't.
Yes.
So there are safety nets in place.
Yeah.
If you're in a certain income bracket, you're eligible for Medicaid, which is sort of an assisted healthcare program, if you're over a certain age. But for everybody else in the middle, it's either you have insurance or you don't.
Yeah.
And the problem is that people who have insurance don't see where the costs are actually, nobody sees where the money is spent.
Oh, of course.
So there's this illusion that the cost comes, it's hard to describe, but basically the people who have insurance are paying for the people who don't.
Yes, yeah.
And so and the actual cost of, say, an MRI, if you have a certain insurance plan, you might spend $15 as your copay for that MRI scan. But no one actually understands how much that costs.
Yes.
Where the money goes and how it's all funded is so opaque.
Yeah.
And so Byzantine that I think very few people have an actual grasp on the economics of the health system in the US, and that's part of the challenge is especially when politicians get involved, it's all politicized and it's hard to have an honest conversation.
Yeah.
And so you studied history at some point in time?
I did. So
how does this slot into your timeline?
So I went to a really unusual medical school.
I feel like you should be like 70
years
old.
How many years
I
am? What do you mean?
I'm trying to do all the math.
Some days. Again, these things that are so serendipitous. I went to pretty much the only medical school in the United States, as far as I know, that has this curriculum where, so you do a lot of your sort of pre-medical courses in undergrad.
And this was Duke.
Yeah, Duke University in North Carolina. And most medical schools, you spend your first 2 years doing mostly classroom things. So you're learning pathology and pharmacology and anatomy and all of that kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
And then your last 2 years are on the wards doing very hands-on. And you're almost like an F1.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're given real responsibility.
Absolutely.
You're putting things in the notes. You're actually your last year, you're carrying a bleep and you're responding.
Yeah.
So you're a little bit like an
F1. Between their final year medical students are so different.
Yeah, it really is. Much more so than our
system,
where you are very babied until you are an F1.
And then you're thrown in the deep end. So my medical school is different. They took the approach that actually most of what you learn in those first 2 years is going to change. By the time you've graduated, it's going to have changed. Like, our knowledge is evolving so quickly that why spend 2 years having you memorize things that are going to be obsolete 3 years down the road? And they felt very strongly that
that's
should...
That's very radical of them.
It is really quite controversial. And they said, well, actually, what we need to do is teach you how to be lifelong learners.
Yeah.
And how to...
I want to go back to your medical school and reattend.
So your first year is then crammed into 13
months.
Can
I ask you a question very quickly? Did people think that your med school was a bit, like, lax because of that?
No, it was because the focus was on research. So most people...
Fine.
So that instead of 2 years of classroom, you do 13 months. So you're kind of taking all that content and drinking it through a fire hose. It's really intensive.
I love that visual.
It's like 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. in lectures, you know.
Yeah.
It's pretty grueling. And then your second year is actually on the ward. So they get you out seeing patients faster.
Okay,
And then your third year is a research year.
Okay.
And that's what lots of people thought, ooh, I don't know if I want to do... Because most people do bench research. They do actual basic science medical research.
Oh, cool.
So there's a lot of people go on to do PhD. It's a very research
heavy.
And so people get, I think lots of people think, ooh, maybe I don't want to do that.
Yeah, that sounds scary.
I mean, it's one of the universities people want to go to.
Yeah.
But I think it tends to self-select people who are more interested in academic medicine.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
So I was the second person ever to do something really quite different with that third year.
Mm-hmm.
And I was the first to go abroad. So I decided instead of doing bench research, which I knew was not going to ring my bell.
Thanks to your year in genetics.
Thanks to my year in genetics. I always thought, I'll do something in public health research or I'll do something that's a bit more, you know, with humans.
Mm-hmm.
But by then I was dating my husband, who we met at a wedding. He's English.
Oh,
and
English.
And I really missed the UK.
Yeah.
I used to get kind of twitchy. I was that bratty American that, like, unless I was getting on an airplane to Europe every once in a while, I just get sort of twitchy.
Yeah.
And I was very twitchy at that point after 2 years of medical school. So I applied to study the history of medicine.
Mm-hmm.
And so my air quotes research year was doing an MA in history of medicine at UCL.
Amazing.
And that was at the Welcome, Trust Center for History of Medicine, which has now sort of been absorbed into UCL proper.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so I was very lucky.
Are you an art student for a year?
I know. I convinced my medical school that that counts as medical school.
That is...
I don't think anyone's done it
amazing.
Since.
Yeah, I was going to say, that is probably, like, the achievement.
Yeah. Yeah. So I did feel rather smug.
Particularly with the Welcome Collection must have been incredible.
So, I mean, I can highly recommend, if anyone can, take a year out and do something different. And even if it's tangentially related, but to be away from the kind of ivory towers of the medical world, because I went into that year quite sure, because again, it's a bit like studying for your degree in the US. You don't know what kind of doctor you're going to be, but in the US, your junior doctor training is packaged. So it's a bit like going to study a course at university. You don't do random doctor jobs like you do here. Yeah. And so as you start getting to the end of medical school, everyone's thinking ahead to what do I want to specialize in? So you make that decision in medical school.
Yeah, of course, of course.
And so, you know, by then, you've done your first year on the wards, you've been exposed to the basics.
Yeah.
You're thinking, what do I want to do? And so I initially was going to do something like most people do from my university, which is go into something quite sort of specialized and prestigious and academic.
It's
almost a culture of wanting to almost prove yourself as well to your colleagues.
And you're still, you know, since you've been in school, right?
Yeah,
it's like you want to get, you want to do the impressive, like the next best thing.
Yeah.
Like you get the good grades, you can go to the good university and you can study medicine. And you're always trying to climb that ladder of doing achieving the most you can achieve. And I think that year for me was an opportunity to step back and say, actually, why did I want to go to medical school in the first place? You know, and so I was, because I was on the track to do sort of anesthesia and critical care, because I learned in medical school.
I was like, that is cool, that is cool.
It is cool, it is cool. And I'm a cool head in a crisis. That's one of the things you realize. And I'm that person who stays calm in the room when someone's really unwell and needing to, so I thought that'll be me. And it was that year out that I thought, hang on, it's been about relationships. Like that's what's drawn me into this. And obviously when you're an anesthetist or in intensive care, most of the time your patient's asleep.
But you do look after the family a lot
of
the time.
You do. It's in a super important role. But I realized I actually wanted to be part of the diagnosis, the kind of mystery of investigations. And I wanted to know what happened to people over the long course. And again, that idea that I would never deliver a baby again or never take care of a child. Or,
you didn't want to let go of any of anything.
I couldn't let go of any of it.
Yeah.
But I had to step away from the pressures of a prestigious academic institution that wanted its graduates to do prestigious things in the world. That I had to step away. And when I came back from that year and said I wanted to do family medicine, I mean, it was like crickets in the room. People were just staring at me with blank faces. Like, have you lost your mind?
Happened?
Have you actually lost your mind?
And what I think is interesting, me and Suba, we talk a lot about the intercalations that we did. Suba did psychology, I did ethics and law. And I think when to do such like arts-focused things can really shape your mind or the way that you now approach the world. Because as you said before, you've gone through school, you've gone through university, everyone's pushing you towards prestigious things, you're quite good at just getting on with it. How do you think that changed your perspective going into the history of medicine? Was there anything that you think has like changed the way you now think about
hugely the world? And you know, people will say like, what's the most profound thing you learned in medical school? And I think, gosh, so much of it came from that, from doing that MA. And I think it's looking at medicine as a lens, and I know this is going to sound really sort of postmodern and artsy, but medicine itself is a construct. It is a conceptualization of health that we have invented because it makes sense.
Absolutely.
And so studying how that has evolved over history and looking how different civilizations and different cultures had their own constructs and looking at that not in a judgmental way. We're not looking to prove who's more right, which is what we're constantly doing in medicine, right? And we have to, because we want to give our patients the best treatment. But when you take off the hat of, I'm looking at this as a clinician, but look at it from a standpoint of almost like a sociologist.
Almost like an anthropology kind of perspective,
And say, gosh, well, this is our best attempt today, or one of the attempts today, of systematizing and understanding what's happening with health in the human body, rather than looking at it as truth with a capital T. And that is, it's a subtle change, but it changed everything about how I practice. And understanding that we're really, this is a lens that we're looking at life through. And it's that lens has changed over time, whether it was Ayurveda or the kind of Greek system, and then even some of the humoral stuff or the medieval stuff. And each of those has its own lens, and that lens is evolving and we're polishing it. And adjusting it as we go, but it's still a lens. It's not, we're not looking at the thing, we're looking at it through a lens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So how do we stop inserting ourselves as like the center of the story as doctors? I'm sure you see lots of your colleagues do that, and actually you've had the privilege of going through these courses and being aware of your mm-hmm. own lens. How do you stop doing that?
I think, well, and this is, I think, where we all agree, I think a lot of it is enriching your life and your awareness and being a learner outside of medicine itself. And mm-hmm. I think, yes, you have to keep up to date on medical literature, and you have to read the journals and, like, do the
We're still doctors.
And I think you have to inform yourself and constantly be developing your understanding of the world outside of medicine. And so whether that's poetry, whether that's theology, philosophy, I think it's being widely read or widely informed and exploring these ideas. And I think also coming back to what was it that drew you into medicine in the first place, kind of your own personal development, I think, and being reflective about this, and not the way that, you know, reflection has become such a portfolio word.
Yeah.
And I think we've almost ruined reflection.
It gives people actual traumatic
feelings.
Yeah, especially the GPs. I feel bad when they have to write them so often.
Exactly.
Yeah. But the actual meaning behind why we are encouraged to do them is a positive thing.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. I mean, Amla used to always touch on how actually when we initially started the podcast, it was such a reflective process for us, and we'd always be talking about these things anyways. It just made sense to start talking about it on a public forum and inviting people to join in.
Yeah.
And when you talk about it in a public forum, then you're forced to like confront what your predispositions are and why you think the way you think. So you just want to be careful when you then see your patients in a private setting.
Yes, absolutely.
So I feel like we have to come on to some other topics because we're going to just be stuck on books and literature
all day
forever, aren't we?
Yeah.
So kind of moving on to when you started practicing as a GP professionally, you were embracing the medical healthcare system in the UK. What happened when you found yourself on the other side?
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Part of that as a patient.
So most people assume that the US and the UK are very different in terms of how medicine is practiced. And actually, they're really not.
Yeah.
And I think, and that's a whole other can of worms we could open up, but the medical culture in the US and the UK is very similar. Mm. And the standards of professionalism, the ethics, it makes sense, right? You know, much of the US system, both our judiciary and our medical system, are directly imported from Great Britain.
Mm-hmm.
And so what's been very interesting to me is seeing how doctors practice, the way we interact with our patients, all of that is very, very similar.
Mm-hmm.
And the actual medicine we practice is very, very similar.
Yeah.
Which is obviously good news for someone trained in the US.
Yeah.
The little system changes, that's really the change. But, you know, even that's not that different. The NHS could well be an insurance company in terms of how you interact with it, and what you're allowed to do and not allowed to do is not even that different.
Yeah.
And so I think the major change for me practicing was the time pressure.
Mm.
And that's been the hardest thing for me to adjust, is the amount of time you have per appointment. Mm. That even in the US, a 15-minute appointment is considered incredibly short.
Wow.
And so to slice that
to 10
was a big shift.
Yeah.
And then obviously you accumulate that through the day. How many patient encounters you have is so, you know, having 20 patient encounters in a day is considered a really full load in the US. Mm-hmm. And often here in general practice, it's, you know, 40 or you hear stories of 60 with that's phone calls and triaging.
Yeah.
And I think that's, you know, on the subject of burnout, I think that if you bring real presence to each interaction, it's not the time you spend, but the individual people that you interact with that I think is a big source of GP burnout in this country.
Really? I mean, it sounds overwhelming to imagine having 40 or 60 patient encounters where you're trying to give the care you want to give.
Yes.
That sounds overwhelming.
But I think any patient, any doctor who's been a patient will relate to suddenly having yourself on the other side of the gown, of the table, of the couch, is a big shift. And I've had, you know, I've not been that, you know, I had a cardiac arrhythmia that was ablated in my, when I was 31. So with my 20s, I was in and out of A&E and I saw cardiologists. It's not like I'd never been a patient before. Yeah. And I had two babies and lost another pregnancy. So, you know, I've had interactions with healthcare, but when I went and I found a breast lump, I was sure it was benign. Mm. My GP was sure it was benign, but because my mom had had breast cancer and she was twitchy, and in the US they start screening mammograms are offered at 40. Yeah. So it's 10 years earlier. My mother was twitchy. So I thought, I'm going to go, I'll get referred. The breast clinic was like, no, we think this is benign, but let's go ahead and do a screening mammogram. And sure enough, the lump was benign, but there were calcifications in the other breast that turned out to be DCIS. Ductal carcinoma in situ, stage zero. But it was a shock, especially as someone who in the kind of lifestyle medicine space was so into, you know, note to self, don't go do a TEDx talk and talk about how preventable cancer is. Tempting fate. I'm like, oh yeah, okay. Yeah. Hashtag tempting fate. So it genuinely did come as a shock. And there's no... So my mother had had genetic testing done when she had her breast cancer and and nothing was found. My father's side, there's no breast or ovarian cancer. And so when a month later I received a diagnosis of a BRCA2 mutation, that came as a complete shock.
It must have done.
Complete shock. And, you know, as a medic, first of all, I felt like a bit of a fool for not having had any breast screening until then, age 40, with a family history. Arguably, I could have gone earlier. And then to not know that there was a hereditary cancer syndrome, you know, I felt like a bit of a numpty. And so there was that, you know, there were so many layers of the, hang on a second, I was eating the kale, I was doing the yoga.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know.
Why me?
I was meditating.
I was doing the meditation. And then also to, oh, by the way, there is a genetic mutation that I probably could have looked at the family tree. You know, there's the perfectionist medic, right? You sort of beat yourself up over. And then also to, I was surprised by the experience of being a cancer patient. That was another love compared to being a cardiac patient or being a pregnant woman.
It's a whole different world, isn't
it? Really is.
Entering like cancer.
In what way? Patient?
I think cancer has a whole mythology in our culture, and there's been some fabulous books written about this, but it does have, considering that most people with a cancer diagnosis survive it now, it still has this kind of association with the Grim Reaper. I mean, it is just the specter of death. And in my own family, you know, my father obviously died of cancer from, you know, arguably one of the scariest ones.
Absolutely.
But we still go instantly into that kind of panic mode with all that cancer is and means and signifies for us in society. But then also the process of getting diagnosed is pretty unpleasant. So I had a really bad experience with my breast biopsy, which I hadn't been prepared for because I, you know, and I have a handful of friends who've had breast cancer and none of them had ever said anything bad about their breast biopsy. And I had a bad experience. It was difficult for them to get the samples. I was in this contorted position, you know, stuck in basically, you're having like a constant mammogram. And for me, it was 2.5 hours.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Of being in a really uncomfortable position.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, with your tit in the clamp.
Yeah, pretty much.
And it was traumatic.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until afterwards that I thought, gosh, that really was traumatic.
Yeah.
And the clinic had run late. And, you know, we all know how it is, right?
Yeah.
The clinic was supposed to be shut. So the lights are switched off. The assistants are all just dying to get home.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was a little bit of a botched job of sort of patching me up and sending me on my way. And I was left crying alone in a dark room at one point. And I thought, this is intense.
Yeah.
I was on my own because it was, you know,
and you
the
didn't
afternoon.
Even expect it was going to be and this was, much of a hassle. So you thought, oh, pop in, pop out.
And I thought it was going to be benign. I really did. Because the mammogram was not even that impressive. Mm-hmm. I really thought it was going to be benign. And yeah. so thinking to myself, gosh, I'm going through all of this for something that's probably going to be nothing.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I think for many breast cancer patients, there's decisions to be made. And it's, you know, in my case, they were... Is it going to be a lumpectomy, a wide local excision? Is it going to be a mastectomy before we had the genetics back?
Mm-hmm.
There's that whole can of worms. And I think, you know, again, this is where there's the science of breast cancer treatment and then there's the human experience.
Mm-hmm.
And for any woman, you know, breasts are highly individual and you're really, it opens up this whole world of femininity, of your relationship with your body.
Mm-hmm.
What do breasts mean to you?
Mm-hmm.
There's obviously society. Has so much to say about women's bodies, and we're, you know, I've never been more aware of how many boobs are on billboards. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, breasts are everywhere. Mm-hmm. They're, and it's, you know, it's on television. It's, you know, my Instagram ads. It's really,
I mentioned it. I'm like, how many boobs have I already seen this morning?
I've got like a highlight section of my stories of all the inappropriate, I think because I've talked on social media about breast cancer, it's like the word breast
is just,
and Instagram's like, oh, she's interested in bras. And so I have these, like, bombarded with bralettes.
I'm so over this.
Like giant close-ups of like a boob on my Instagram.
Like how often can you report these before like they'll leave you alone?
Exactly. So I got hiking boot ads the other day, and I'm like, they're learning.
Yeah,
they're learning.
I like the nature.
Yeah, I was like, give me the hiking boots. So, and then I think for, and I don't know whether this would have been different in the U.S. I mean, I went along with some of my mother's appointments when she was going through breast cancer treatment. But there's not much, in my experience, there was no conversation started by any of my, and I interviewed a lot of surgeons. I always tell my GP, in general practice, I tell my patients, got to be a bit American about this.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, you can get a second opinion in the NHS.
Yeah.
You actually have choice over which hospital you go to.
Mm-hmm.
You can shop around.
Yeah.
And for most people... with breast cancer, it's not an emergency.
Mm-hmm.
And I know there's this urgency once you know it's in there, you're
to
desperate
out.
To get it out.
And for your own sort of state of like
yes.
what's happening, what's the plan, what's next?
Yes, we're desperate to get on with it, but actually making sure you feel 100% comfortable
mm-hmm.
with your surgeon, with the team
mm-hmm.
yeah.
that you're getting care from. So because I had a bad experience
like,
mm-hmm. as my biopsy, I shopped around.
I see.
Yeah.
And so that added to the time that I was waiting. And then Christmas rolled around. And for DCIS, I mean, it's stage zero. Nobody ever dies from DCIS.
Mm-hmm.
And so none of the surgeons were in a hurry. And everyone
mm-hmm.
said, wait till after Christmas to have your surgery.
And did
yeah.
you feel comfortable waiting till after Christmas?
No, I did get a little bit too American at first.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, oh my gosh, if I was in the States, this would be all behind me
mm-hmm.
in like a minute and a half.
Mm-hmm.
Because they don't have the wait times.
Yeah.
That we have here.
Yeah.
Everything just moves faster. But in hindsight, I'm really, really glad that I had that time
mm-hmm.
to reflect. Again.
You're processing so much. Like, not
yes.
only have you gone from being like, I've got a benign breast lump to, oh, no, I haven't. And, oh, there's this gene mutation to, okay, and what does this mean for what the treatment's going to be? What's the
yes.
what's the best choice? And then also you're coming from that not only as, you know, a person who's experiencing this in your life, but also as someone who's got medical background. So you're like,
yes.
well... should I be reading things? Should I be, you know, and you're going to be like, let me check what's, you know.
Oh yeah.
What's
like reading
said.
All the books and like,
yeah.
on all the, you know, social media is a bit of a minefield
mm-hmm.
when it
yeah.
comes to cancer. And I found myself actually not wanting to consume
Engage.
Much of anything. Cause there's
mm-hmm.
so much garbage,
yeah.
so much garbage. And
mm-hmm.
that's become something I'm really passionate about now. Even in lifestyle medicine, there's an awful lot of really misleading, yeah.
Yeah.
really hurtful information. And
yeah.
I think the more, and I'm aware of this too, the more we bang on about how preventable cancer is, once you've had that diagnosis, there's a lot of guilt and blame that comes with it. And you think, okay, what did I do? I must have done something wrong if this
yeah.
is preventable.
Someone's jumping up to tell you that you should have had more turmeric and you should have...
Yeah, 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 exactly.
You know, had more greens and eaten less McDonald's or something.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. But in all of my interactions with... surgeons
mm-hmm.
and so I ultimately spoke to four surgeons before I actually proceeded with the double mastectomy I had in January of this year. Not one asked me kind of what my experience has been and sort of what how I was feeling emotionally
mm-hmm.
and I thought that did shock me
mm-hmm.
because I thought that we had sort of gotten to a place where we understood, and again maybe that's just not the focus of the surgeon. I'm not expecting them to give me
yeah
like a counseling session
mm-hmm. yeah.
but especially when you're talking about surgical options for breast cancer. That has to be a piece of it.
Yeah, I'm quite surprised to hear that.
I was going to say, that surprises me slightly.
Because I think of all the fields, I was under the impression, and from my experience, that the cancer fields are often better at acknowledging the holistic nature of how we need to approach those issues.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And how, you know, you have, you know, the Macmillan nurses that come in and are giving you practical advice on money and how you're going to finance yourself and what you're going to do about work.
And then I suppose the lens that you come from as a Macmillan nurse must be very different from a surgical training kind of standpoint.
Mm. And again, I was lucky that I didn't need chemotherapy and I didn't need radiotherapy. Mm. And so I was, you know, I think with DCIS, you're in a slightly different bucket.
Mm.
And I remember turning to the breast nurse right after I got the diagnosis, and they sort of, and again, you know, the surgeon has done her bit. The surgeon who gave me my diagnosis had done her bit. And then I was like whisked away to the nurse. Like, now if you're going to talk about her, you're going to start crying. Yeah. Like, off you go to the side room with the nurse.
Yeah.
And I remember turning to her and saying, so, do I actually have breast cancer? Like, are we calling DCIS cancer these days? Because it's quite controversial. Yeah. And I think easily in 5 years, we're going to be saying, actually, I didn't have breast cancer. Because DCIS is it pre-cancer or cancer?
Mm-hmm.
But I actually turned to her and sort of said, do I have breast cancer?
Like, can you break it down?
What are you kids calling it these days? You know, I feel out of touch. And she, you know, because it is, I think it's a different thing. They don't sort of pile on Macmillan nurses, and certainly they didn't for me.
But then you're kind of in a sort of twilight zone where you're like, well, I'm having all these things happen.
Yes.
And
I'm having a double mastectomy, but there's no one...
There's no social support, or psychological support, anyone checking in on...
So the experience of being a doctor in that scenario, did you feel like that gave you more power, or did it kind of like give you less power in the sense that you felt a bit silly asking these questions?
I definitely felt like I had more power.
Okay.
And I think that was in the back of my mind. I kept thinking, gosh, if I'm finding this hard, what does the average woman who doesn't have a medical background? And one of the things that I've been, you know, I've shared on social media is I did not have breast reconstruction. And that was, I think, again, part of why, I mean, with medics, give us a chance to talk about science or talk about the heart, and what are we going to do? Of course, we're going to talk about science and talk about the kind of physical body. And for me, one of the reasons I sort of got different opinions was because reconstruction was going to be a challenge for me. And so the surgeon would much rather talk about technical aspects of breast surgery rather than talk about like the meaning of this.
Yeah.
And actually the surgeon I had, I mean, he's brilliant. It sounds like I'm being critical of him. He was brilliant.
And
he did more than any of the others in sort of at the outset acknowledging that mastectomy is not just a physical
change
process.
Yeah.
But he never once suggested that I not have breast reconstruction.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were going round and round the houses about, you know, I'm too slim to have autologous reconstruction, where they, you know, like the Dieppe procedure where they can use your own flesh to build a breast. And so he sent me off, though, for another, to see if even the wizard plastic surgeon could like, scrape some flesh from somewhere. Like, he was it. And no, the answer was no.
Mm-hmm.
But then it was, for someone who is very tall, like me, implant reconstruction is not as straightforward as I think the media makes it seem.
Mm.
And so he wanted to be very real about kind of what the risk, the very, you know, the operative risk was going to be, like the 30% range, which is very high.
Mm. 30% is massive.
It's massive. And that's for, you know, infection, tissue necrosis, need for reoperation.
Yeah.
You know, my pectoral muscles would have to be cut. You know, there was all these sort of, it was going to be full on.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until I said, well, what if I just don't have reconstruction? Mm-hmm. And there was this amazing moment where his breast nurse was in the room and he looked at her and they exchanged this look and it was like relief.
I wish I was in that room.
Yeah.
It was an amazing moment where he said they locked eyes and exchanged this expression. He said, yes, we've been trying to decide whether we should suggest this to you. And they clearly just weren't comfortable having that conversation.
That.
And I thought, oh my gosh, like this is so clearly the right thing for me to do.
Yeah.
And they didn't feel like it was a conversation they could have. And I thought, that's because we haven't talked about it yet.
But we don't think about that, do we?
Yeah. And because we hadn't ever had a conversation about body image.
Yeah.
That they didn't
They couldn't gauge where what that meant to you and where you were coming from, which is the biggest part of ever saying something like that to somebody. You can't just come in and say, have you thought about not having reconstructive surgery to someone you've never had that conversation.
Exactly. Because I'd had so many consultations at this point with them, I think they felt like it was too late to say, well, hang on, let's take a step back and like, what do breasts mean to you? And what do you feel about your body? And what's important to you? What are your priorities? Like all of these really basic questions. And so, so I felt very fortunate that I, knowing my options as well as I did and knowing what the very real operative risks meant and what that actually looked like, because I'd seen, we've all seen people having surgical complications, and I knew that that number was too high for me.
And also I think a big part of, I think something we should touch on is that you talking about how being a doctor felt like you had more power because of that, in that relationship is important, because often if someone is coming from a background where they feel like you're coming to an expert to give you the advice and to give you the recommendations, then you may not think to bring something up if they've not brought it up, because you're thinking, well, you're the expert, you're going to give me the advice and you're going to give me the recommendations. So the fact that you were coming from an environment where you're saying, well, I'm going to shop around actually and find the person that I have the best fit with, fine, okay, I feel comfortable in my relationship with you now to say, can we think about this?
Yeah.
Even if they haven't.
Yeah.
And that's crucial.
I think there's still, especially here in the UK, very much a culture of do what the doctor says. And I think that's really unhelpful. It's unhelpful for doctors. It's difficult to work with that if you're the doctor and you're trying to do some shared decision making with your patient, if they just want you to tell them what to do. Mm-hmm. But then as a patient, it means it's a lot harder to advocate for yourself.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons that I really, that I actually chose my surgeon in the end is because, again, I felt empowered to like look him up on med, and sort of, I knew that he had a PhD, so I was like, let's read what he does in research in. And he'd written a paper about medical errors. And he'd written a case report that was published of something going wrong in a wide local excision, where a woman who'd been diagnosed with breast cancer was going in to have a lumpectomy. And everyone had explained to her multiple times that right before she had her surgery, they were going to put a wire in to identify the spot. And so she knew this. It was explained many times. And somehow with the checklist, it failed, and she went straight from pre-op into theater without having the wire placed and was put under. And it wasn't until the surgeon came in and said, hang on, where's the wire, that they discovered the mistake. And so he'd written this fabulous paper about how she knew that she was supposed to have that wire, and she didn't say, hang on, folks, why haven't I gotten
the wire?
Where's my wire? And so that's what he was interested in, is how is this broken down, both on our end, but also how have we put a patient in a situation where she didn't feel like she could question her care?
Oh, I love him.
I know. Yeah. That's why I was like, that's
I'm going to start reading people's papers now. Because I don't even care about the, you know, the iwantgreatcare.com reviews.
Yeah.
No. I want to know that you really deeply understand what it means to not stand up for yourself.
Like, I want to make sure that he's taken all the breast cells he can take, and I want pretty scars. And I want
someone who's thinking,
like,
about,
thinking about some of this stuff.
What a dope guy.
So, I know that you're really open on social media about your experiences, about going through your double mastectomy and what that means for you and what sort of message you want to share with other people that are looking at your social media about that.
I'm like, what question is she about to ask?
What I want to ask is, I know that you actually had a social media presence prior to all of this, didn't you?
Yes.
So how did that evolve with then you getting your diagnosis, going through all of this? Were you sort of actually very frank and open at the time, just sharing all of this?
Well, and it was sort of accidental. And I don't, I think, again, because I was so convinced that the lump was benign, as I came home, when I had gone to my GP about the lump and came home, I realized that my shirt was on inside out. I just started laughing, and I just thought, if this is not a, like, you know, Instagram real world moment, I don't know what it is. And I'd clearly been a little bit rattled, but I just had my top off, having my breasts examined by my doctor, and then put the shirt on inside out and hadn't noticed and was walking around my daily life.
In a hurry just to get out of the clinic.
I had been very vulnerable, so might as well just continue at this point.
And I thought, well, I know that I've heard from women that they worry and they find something that they're worried about and they don't go in. And so I thought, well, I'm going to just do a quick live about what I just did and why and what the process is, especially here in the UK, to demystify it a little bit. In the back of my mind, knowing that it was likely to be benign.
Not even thinking what is going to happen.
It was very unlikely, but I want to share the experience so that people aren't so frightened. And because I'll talk about integrative medicine and lifestyle. I do have a component of my following is deeply distrustful of medicine.
Yeah.
And so the more I can build bridges and sort of help people understand what the process looks like.
Absolutely, and what an opportunity to...
And so it was sort of accidental, and then it was like, oh, okay, now I'm having a mammogram, and oh, now I'm having a biopsy.
Was that stuff you were sharing at the time?
Yes.
Because you're so open on your social media, so I imagine that you would have.
So I was like, well, again, the goal is to demystify this, and yeah. I think, again, when it comes to the medical gaze on the female body, the more we can drag things out of shameful shadows, I think it's so important that we have to stop treating things like breast lumps as some sort of dark secret. Because I think that's
you sound like Bernie Brown now.
Oh, it's so unhelpful. Because those are things we keep. Those are things that we keep hidden.
Yeah,
and then
and we don't talk about and we don't share our stories of to make other people feel like actually, it's fine.
Exactly.
But can I ask when you start sharing things? Obviously, you get responses back. Did any of the responses that you got back surprise you in any way, or what was like the form of people's opinion?
So when I did a short video on the biopsy experience and how traumatic it had been, and my DMs were flooded, and I mean flooded as an overwhelming number of people that I couldn't begin to keep track of who'd had a traumatic experience at the hands of healthcare, including doctors. And that really took me by surprise. I didn't know the extent to which people have had bad experiences in healthcare. Because up until then, I hadn't had one as a patient. And so that was the biggest surprise I had, was how many people had thought that it was okay to walk away from a medical experience feeling really quite traumatized. And that came as a surprise. And then it's all overwhelmingly been positive, and including really gratifyingly several women who have said, actually, there's a lump I've been worried about, and this has given me the confidence to go get it checked out. And I thought, well, this is what we need, because it's a private part of our bodies, but that doesn't mean that we should, you know, keep these hidden worries. And obviously the longer we sit on things, that's not good for anyone.
Not at all.
No, absolutely. And I remember at med school being told the fact that women that find a breast lump that share that with a friend or with a family member or a partner, sooner rather than later, go and get seen quicker and things get managed quicker.
Yes.
By someone who doesn't say anything to anybody, may keep that to themselves for weeks until things may progress, or, you know, only seek care at a much later time. So
yes, exactly.
Talking about it and not feeling ashamed or thinking of the breasts as a secretive...
Yeah.
Part of your body is it's really important to change that narrative, isn't it?
And to open up the conversation, I think, about what our breasts mean to our identity as women, but also in society. I think that's a conversation that's long overdue, and I think the pendulum has swung. You know, it used to be that no one ever got breast reconstruction, and then I think we've seen because we're trying to compensate for that in medicine and making sure that women do have that option, because that is the right option for a lot of women, that we now almost push the pendulum too far the other way. Actually, we have to make sure that people have genuine, informed choices.
Yes.
Yeah.
And are empowered to make that decision no matter what they decide. And then to normalize, I think, body differences. I mean, this is a whole other conversation.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about this until today, actually.
You know, even it sounds really silly, but one of the biggest decisions for me since my surgery has been, do I wear a prosthetic breast or not? And it's uncomfortable, and I feel a little silly. Yes, it makes the clothes look normal, and that's what the plastic surgeon I saw, and, you know, no, any surgeons who are listening, never say this to anybody ever, but he told me that I have had a terrific figure. This is pre-surgery, and so his argument for having implant reconstruction was that...
Let's maintain this terrific figure.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
And so I just thought, gosh, he really doesn't know me at all, does he? And so... Again, there's this conception that we have to maintain the body that social, you know, advertisements and magazines and social, like, that we're told is what a normal woman's body looks like.
And that's the thing, I feel like with a woman's body, so much of it is about, well, for who?
Yes.
For whose consumption?
Yes.
What about me, like, living in the body?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's such a big part of it.
And especially because a reconstructed breast is numb.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not, and that's, again, that's not talked about. And I had a lot of women who had breast reconstruction reach out and say, actually, no one told me that I wouldn't have any sensation. Like, it's not, it's not a real breast.
It's just
not until you've even said that now that I've been like, I've always assumed that there would be.
Yes, and some women will have some amount of skin sensation.
But it's not.
But even if the nipple is preserved, it doesn't have sensation. So again, it really does become, like, who am I reconstructing this breast for? For whose pleasure?
Absolutely. And what an important thing to tell women that are going to have that surgery. because those things aren't without risks, like you pointed out. And yes, also there's a, you know, body of evidence that will come with time to say, well, what other things might be happening with reconstructive surgeries that we don't know about because they've not been done in such numbers until now.
And the implants I was offered were recalled. So the implants I said no to have since been recalled from the market. And it's that sort of level of, you know, again, the implant reconstruction is absolutely the right choice for many women. Mm-hmm. But I think this is a conversation as a society that it's, and it's helpful because then, you know, for me, the, it became very clear that actually I'm much more comfortable not wearing prosthetic breasts. I don't wear prostheses. And actually, you know, I'm tall and I'm slim and it looks okay.
Yeah.
But I have a new awareness now. And you gosh, there's a lot of people who walk around who don't have the option of wearing a prosthesis to make their body look more normal, to make everybody else more comfortable. Mm-hmm. And I think it's this new awareness that I have. And actually, if you know what, if someone looks at me on the tube and thinks, she looks a bit funny, you know, actually, there's someone else who's going to look at me and find that reassuring and think, me too.
Yeah.
And I think that's for, that for me feels like living with integrity.
Yeah. I feel like that's such a... just even from following you on social media and meeting you, I feel like that's such a core tenet of, I feel like, how you try and live your life, like just trying to be really authentically yourself.
Thank you. That's such a compliment.
Yeah, I really get that from you. We are so short on time. I feel like we could chat forever.
Yeah. Lots of people that we meet will be distrustful of healthcare and our approaches to medicine. And that's even people who have been brought up in like Western civilizations. For those patients that we come into contact with and already feel judged by the medical profession, I also would love to hear, how do we, once again, not insert our beliefs on them, and how we can almost jump that barrier with them of just saying, look, I'm here to look after you. Yeah, I'd just love to hear what your thoughts are on that.
I think it comes from approaching that conversation with a place of humility, because I think we are seeing, and the statistics show this, that trust in medical institutions is been dropping ever since the mid-80s. And, you know, alternative and holistic medicine and complementary therapies are as popular as they've ever been. And I think it's worth reminding, and I feel this as a doctor, when I feel moments of frustration over something I might see online or something a patient says, is that respect is earned. And if we've lost respect as a profession, that we need to take ownership of that and not blame, oh, it's because holistic providers are smelling or selling snake oil. No, it's actually because people have stopped trusting us, and that's on us. And so I tend to approach those conversations with a huge amount of humility and respect for where the other person has come from. Because as I learned from my own social media DMs, often those people have experienced really bad things. And so I think I approach it from a space of listening, asking questions, honoring that person's experience. And then once you've done that, it's actually not that hard to engage in a partnership with that patient. If you've done the groundwork first of seeing them as a person, honoring the experience that they have and the opinions they have and the life they've led. Again, remembering that everyone is bringing their own constructed vision and everyone's looking at this through their own lens, then it's easy not to judge someone else's lens if you've seen it and recognized it for what it is. And then, yeah, and just making it very much a respectful conversation. And then in my experience, I don't have a hard time building that relationship. And I'm convinced that part of why people love, and myself included, I love getting a massage, and I love going to an osteopath, like bring on the sound baths, like all of that. And I think that's because of how people feel.
Yeah.
You know, it's Maya Angelou, I'm paraphrasing her quote, that says people won't remember what you said, but they'll always remember how you made them feel.
Yeah.
And I think people feel cared for when they see, you know, alternative therapists, say, or complementary therapists. They feel cared for. They feel like they're... their whole experience of life, not just their illness, is being recognized. And I think that's something we can learn from a medicine, that how we make people feel really matters. It's not just what we prescribe or the surgery we do on their bodies, but how do we make them feel? I think there was a quote from this book that I'm reading. That
I can't wait to read this one.
Give it to us.
So it's...
the last education, guys.
Blaise Pascal, you know, he was a mathematician and a physicist and a theologian. And he said that reason's last step is recognizing that an infinity of things surpass it. And I think it's worth keeping that. I think that keeps us humble and keeps us honest. The medicine is recognizing what we know and what we don't know. And that even if someone has a reason for a different decision than we would necessarily choose for ourselves, that doesn't make it wrong. Mm-hmm. It's just their experience.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I feel like that was a lesson in like servitude, lesson in like humility to our patients.
Yeah.
And I hope that conversation is useful for our listeners today. So thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much,
Robin.
Thank you.
And Robin, just to finish off, how do people like find you or engage in the work that you do?
So I'm on Instagram, Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
It's at Dr.
Old school.
I'm actually relatively new to Instagram. It's only been 2 years on Instagram.
Oh,
I'm
wow.
such a dinosaur. Facebook and Instagram, Dr. Robin Fawcett.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
So everyone, take care. Have a great day, because I'm going to have a great day now.
Bye. Bye.
Catch us over on www.afterthelettersdotcom or /aftertheletterson every social media network.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.